Well, Merry Christmas, Village Church. If you don't know me, I'm Matt. I'm one of the pastors here at the Village. I'm glad to be with you this morning celebrating Christmas. If you're a guest with us, I want to invite you into what we've been doing over the month of December during our Advent series, in a series we're calling Faith for Christmas. And so far, we've looked at the faith of the prophets. We've looked at the prophet Micah. We've looked at the faith of Joseph, the faith of Mary. They had quite a role in this story, as you know. And this morning, we're going to be looking at the faith of the wise men. The faith of the wise men. And the faith of the wise men definitely is a journey of faith. Both literally, it was a 900-mile journey to get to Jesus. Also, a journey of faith kind of figuratively in a sense. They are an example or a model to some of us in some way of what it looks like for us to come to Jesus and come to faith eventually in Jesus. For many of us, the idea of a journey to faith is a little foreign. Maybe it was more like a jaunt than a journey for us. We came to faith very early in life. And so for many of us as Christians, we came to faith maybe at the age of some of our kids, right, that we just saw singing. We came to faith early in life. And so it wasn't so much a journey to faith, but we're experiencing a journey in our faith, in our faith in Jesus. We're continuing to grow and journey in our faith with him. But for others of us, this idea of a journey of faith makes a ton of sense. Because our journey to faith in Jesus took a long time. And maybe there were some starts and there were some stops. Maybe there were some forks in the road. We took like the longest route, right? When you put into Google Maps, you know, it would have been like not the fastest route. For some reason, we chose the one at the bottom, right? We just wanted to take more time to get there. I don't know, but eventually we came to faith. And for some of us, that's our story. And if that's our story, you can relate to the story of the wise men. I'm sure in a way many of us may not. And for others of us, maybe you're here this morning, we're still on a journey to faith in Jesus, and maybe that would describe you. And so my hope for all of us, no matter where we are, coming to Jesus, or we've already come to Jesus, and we're still continuing in our walk with or our journey of faith in Jesus and in growth in him, or whether we're just here this morning and we're kind of on the path for the first time, we're trying to get on the path toward a journey to Jesus. My hope this morning is that the example of the wise men, the model of the wise men could be an example for us and it could strengthen our faith. For some of us, we want and we need our faith strengthened. And for maybe others of us, that we might actually come to faith for the first time. So the journey actually starts in verse 1 of chapter 2 in the Gospel of Matthew, where it says this. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, and I just want to pause there and say, this is an actual, literal, historical story. So when I use the term story, I'm not talking about like a book that you read during Christmas time, you know, that's sort of a fanciful story about Christmas. This is an actual historical account. It's not a fictional journey meant to simply teach a moral lesson. It's a historical, factual account. There was a king named Herod that ruled over this area during the reign of the Roman Empire, and this is an actual historical event. So just press pause for that. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem during the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." And here this morning, I think we learned at the beginning that our journey of faith begins by receiving what has been revealed to us about Jesus. That our journey of faith really begins by receiving what has been revealed to us about Jesus. And the question for the wise men is, what has been revealed to them? They're wise men who have come from the east. What could they possibly know about Jesus? And I think we know they know at least three things. One, they know that the God of the Bible was claimed to be the God of creation. We know that they know that. And we know that they know that the God of the Bible had offered or declared, rather, that he would send a kind of divine leader into human history, and that this leader would have a divine origin and that he would come to the city of Bethlehem. And we know that they know perhaps that this divine leader would rule not just over literally the Jews, would be the king of the Jews, but over the entire world. We know that they know at least those three things. And at this point in their journey to faith in Jesus or their journey to Jesus, they don't know a lot, but in a sense, they kind of do. And maybe that would describe you this morning. Maybe you know some details, like maybe you would know that the God of the Bible is the God of creation, or that Jesus is sort of this divine leader. You hear people talking about Jesus, fully God and fully man. How does that work and who could he be? You don't know all the details about the story, but you know enough. These wise men didn't know all of the details, but they knew enough. And the question is, how did they know that? How did these wise men from the east know these things about who Jesus would be? I think they knew it in three ways. The first way is what theologians call general revelation. That was the stars. General revelation. Theologians say that we can know about God just by the things that there are in creation. In Psalm 19, it says it this way: the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky proclaims his handiwork. And these wise men from the east, these magi, they were astronomers, astrologers from Persia or from Babylon, who made their entire life, made their entire living out of studying the stars and studying the cosmos. And they understood that there was a creator. And what they saw, a star in the heavens, what they saw was either an astronomical event like a comet or the planets aligning or some kind of meteor shower. Apparently last night there was a meteor shower or some kind of satellite breaking up, right? If you saw it in space, something was coming, something was happening. And theologians tell us that at this point in human history, we see some of these things. We see these kind of astronomical events happening. Could have been something like that, that they associated with something important in their time and place and culture. Or maybe it was just a supernatural event, like similar to the cloud of smoke by day and the pillar of fire by night that led the people of Israel through their wilderness wanderings. A supernatural event that God used to direct them to Jesus had nothing to do with a meteor or with a star or with the lining of planets or something like this. But either way, in his sovereignty, God used nature. And God used the things that they were naturally interested in the world, the stars, to begin to reveal himself to them. And maybe this has been the reality for you. Maybe there's some general revelation as you look at things around you. You see hints of the creation and the creator. But there's also special revelation. It wasn't just that they looked up at the stars and they said, oh, Jesus is coming, we should get to Bethlehem. There was also what theologians call special revelation. There was the Bible. There was the Old Testament of the Bible. As astrologers and as these magi connected these supernatural events or these astronomical events about, and they connected it with the coming expectation of a Jewish Messiah or king from the Old Testament. And likely this happened because they heard about these things through, you know, passed down through people like Daniel. And if you read the book of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or just the average ordinary Jewish people that were in exile in Babylon. Maybe verses like this out of Numbers 24. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall raise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break all the nations of Sheth. Prophecies about a star that's going to rise, that they're associating with a ruler, these guys who studied the stars for their life and their living. Or maybe it was Micah 2, which we started our series with as we looked at Micah chapter 5. But you, O Bethlehem, Ephrathah, who are not little among too little among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth from me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from old, from ancient days, which literally means from eternity coming into human history. Or maybe it was Daniel himself that wrote down his prophecy, and maybe they kept the prophecies of Daniel. Daniel had worked his way up high into the ranks of the government in that city and nation. And in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel makes a prophecy about when this ruler would come. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of the anointed one, the Messiah, the king, the prince, there shall be 7 weeks. And then for 62 weeks, it shall be built up again in the squares and the moat, but in a troubled time. And so at this point in their journey, they know some details. The details are being filled in through the incredibly detailed revelation of the Bible, of God's word to us, describing to us who he was and what he would do and how he would come into human history. So there was general revelation, the cosmos. There was special revelation. There was the Old Testament Bible. And I sort of made up a third category, if it's okay with you this morning. Theologians don't use this, but I'm going to use it this morning. And it's just relational revelation. And it's just simply to say that none of this would have happened without God's people. That God's people, many of them educated like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, many of them uneducated like the average ordinary Jew that found themselves in exile in Babylon, likely are the people who shared these things with people like the Magi, and these things were passed down to them. And whatever details the wise men knew They would have never known these things without God's people being faithful to share it. And if you're part of the Village Church, you know that last weekend we ended our service with a benediction out of Romans chapter 10, which says this: how then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they going to believe in him who have they not heard? And how are they going to hear without someone preaching? And how are they going to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. This would have never happened unless God's people had shared these things with the people around them. And we're going to end our time together this morning by talking briefly about that. But at this point in the journey, they had a lot revealed to them through the creation that they regarded, through the Jewish scriptures that they respected, and through some of God's people who they respected enough to listen and to learn. So what did they do with what had been revealed to them? They had a lot revealed to them, but what did they do with what had been revealed to them? We know that they received it, and they responded to it by listening and by learning and by waiting. Waiting for God to tell them what the next step on their journey toward Jesus would be. And let me tell you, the next step was a big one. It was a 900-mile journey. The next step that God would ask them to take in their journey to Jesus was a massive step, and they took it. And they found their way to Jerusalem. The question this morning for us is, what has been revealed to you about who Jesus is? For many of you, it's been revealed to you that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, the Savior of the world. And you've placed your faith and your hope and your trust in him. For some of you, it's been revealed to you that Jesus is a significant historical figure, more significant than anyone else. And maybe he is divine in some way. The question this morning at the beginning of our time is, what has been revealed to you about who Jesus is, and what are you doing with this? Maybe you've been out in God's creation, and you're in the ocean, or you're in the mountains, or you're someplace that you love to be doing an activity that you love, and you see the light coming through the trees, or you see the fish swimming through the water, or whatever it might be, and you just say, this couldn't happen by accident, and it's general revelation that's been revealing these things to you. Maybe for some of you, you've heard Bible verses, or you've turned on the radio, or you've watched a podcast, or maybe a friend has shared something with you. Maybe you've opened the Bible. Maybe for most of you, you've studied the Bible a lot. God's been revealing a lot to you about who he is through the special revelation. Or maybe it's sometimes relational revelation. Maybe there's someone that you respect that has been pointing these things out to you. They've been telling you things like, when you look at creation, you really think that all happened by accident. And in your heart and mind, you know, like, no, this can't just happen all by accident. And you have someone saying, well, you know, there's an explanation about how this happened. It's the God of the Bible. It's Jesus. And they begin sharing these things with you. Maybe there's someone you respect that's been sharing these things with you along your journey. What are you doing with what has been revealed to you about Jesus this Christmas? I was going to say, for all of us, our journey to faith begins by receiving what has been revealed to us about Jesus. But there's more to the journey than that. And we find it starting in chapter 3, or verse 3, rather, where it says, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet. It's prophet Micah. We just read this verse. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. And after listening to the king, they went on their way. Here, I think, secondly, we learned this morning that our journey of faith continues by overcoming the fear that keeps us from Jesus. Our journey of faith continues by overcoming the fear that keeps us from Jesus. The greatest obstacle to faith in Jesus, the greatest obstacle to our journey of faith in Jesus, is fear. It's fear of the implications of placing our faith in Jesus. It's fear of the implications of following Jesus. It's the thing that keeps us from following Jesus the most. This is why in the Bible, the greatest command in the Bible is do not fear or fear not. There's no greater command in the Bible. It's mentioned no more times than do not fear or fear not. for this reason. Fear oftentimes, most oftentimes, is pushing up against the faith that we desire to have in Jesus. And as the wise men walk into Jerusalem, they are surrounded by fear, at least three kinds of fear they're surrounded by. The first is a paranoid fear. And we see this through the life of Herod. It's a paranoid fear. It's the fear that Jesus will take away everything that you've built. It's a paranoid fear. Many people have this fear today, that Jesus will take away everything you've built. If you put faith in Jesus, he's going to take everything that you have built. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. He was troubled. This word troubled means that he was agitated. Like on the inside, his gut was turning. Like this, it created anxiety. It was a physiological word that created all kinds of like panic attacky kinds of feelings in Herod. Herod was moved by this in a physiological kind of way. That's how much fear he had. That's how paranoid he had. And Herod, in his paranoia, historically did some very irrational things. Herod was afraid, he was paranoid that someone was going to steal his kingdom. And so Herod took 10 wives so that he could have a lot of sons, so that he could have heirs to his throne. But eventually, Herod became paranoid that one of his sons would take the kingdom from him. And so Herod killed his sons. He killed his favorite son, Antipater. Herod was so paranoid that people would steal his kingdom, that they would take what he had built, that he'd built palaces all up and down the eastern realm of his kingdom so that if someone came in Jerusalem, he could flee to one palace or another or another. He had a place to hold up and gather his army and sort of kind of get his troops together and fight off whatever resistance would be to the things that he had built. And in this story, we know, we didn't read it this morning, but he killed all the babies in Bethlehem, 2 years old and younger, when he heard about the birth of Jesus, because he was paranoid. He did something irrational, which wasn't hard for him. He had already killed his own children. Why would he have a hard time killing other people's children? This isn't a story. This is a historically documented event. And these are the kinds of things that people do when they get paranoid. And Herod is paranoid that Jesus is going to come and take everything that he built. Herod had built beautiful palaces. He helped to do some work on the temple. Like Herod was well known for his architecture and the things that he had built an incredible kingdom, and he was afraid that Jesus would take it. Herod was a fearful man who was fearful that Jesus would take what he had built. I think many people today are also paranoid about this. They're paranoid about this idea that Jesus is just going to take everything that I've built. And so in their paranoia, they do some irrational things. They hedge themselves in with people that just think the way that they think. They're not open to talk about Jesus. They say, oh yeah, I'm a very open person. I'm open to all kinds of things. Well, except maybe for Jesus. They are unopen to reading or listening to anything about Jesus. You hand them a book and say, hey, this really explains this. Or, hey, this explains in scientific terms kind of the creation story. Or this explains the way this happens. They're like, no. And they're not open to hearing or reading. They just hedge themselves in, never willing to have a conversation talking about who Jesus really is. Because they're paranoid that Jesus is going to take away everything that they've built. Question this morning, do you happen to have any kind of paranoid fear that Jesus is going to kind of just take the things that you have built? There's a second kind of fear that the shepherds were surrounded by. It was a paralyzing fear. And this was the fear of the masses. Is that the fear that Jesus would shake up the status quo. It was a paralyzing fear that something would happen to shake up the status quo and it would have an implication for them and their lives. Herod was already the king of the Jews. And these wise men are announcing there's someone that's going to be born in Bethlehem, and he's the actual king of the Jews. And this was going to shake up the whole political and sociological culture of the city of Jerusalem, and they weren't really sure how to respond to it. It was a paralyzing kind of fear. And if a paranoid fear is a personal fear that kind of tears at us inside and kind of even has some physiological kind of effects to it, I think this paralyzing fear is more of a social fear. How will the people and culture around them treat them if they acknowledge Jesus and they place their faith in Jesus? How would things change in their culture because of Jesus? What would Herod do? What would the people in power do if they declared their allegiance to Jesus? How would things change for them economically? How would it affect their work? How would things change for them socially with their relatives and their friends? How would their family change? How much social credit would they give up if they had to make a decision to follow Jesus instead of follow the whims of prevailing culture? And this could be a paralyzing kind of fear. It could cause you to do nothing at all. It just paralyzes you. You don't make a decision because the implications maybe just, well, I feel too overwhelming. And I call this a paralyzing fear because this is what this kind of fear does. It paralyzes us. It causes us to just stop and do nothing in regard to our journey of faith in Jesus. And this is what many people do today when they're fearful Jesus will shake up the status quo of their lives. How would things change with my family if I decided to sort of get on a journey to understanding who Jesus is and maybe even following him? What would that do to my family? What would that do to my relationships, the people that know me the best? How would my friendships change? How would that affect my work and my ability to earn money? Like, what am I going to do? How would that affect my ethics and the way I function in the world? How much social credit would I have to give up in this culture? How many followers would I have to lose? Would I get sort of, banned or, can't think of the word, but canceled is it? Thank you. If I'm following Jesus, like I'm an influencer. I mean, I'm not an influencer. But I got a lot of followers. They follow me about once a year, twice a year I post something, and I keep them waiting. But like, what would the implications be, right? Question, do you have any paralyzing fear that's keeping you from faith in Jesus or from growing in faith in Jesus? Just the implications of what that next thing, that next step of faith for you would be, and you're like, oh, I just don't know, and it just paralyzes you. But there's a third kind of fear, and it's the last one this morning, is a pessimistic fear. And this is the chief priests and the scribes. And I think it's the fear that Jesus is not the one you were really hoping for. Fear that Jesus is not the one you were really hoping for. See, the chief priests and the scribes were hoping for this ruler, hoping for the Messiah. They've been studying about him. They've been hoping for him for over 700 years or 400 years since the last revelation of this happening. It had been hundreds of years that people like them had been studying and waiting, and he just didn't come the way they expected him to come. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we've seen the stars and it rose, and we've come to worship him. They hear it proclaimed. For hundreds of years, they've been waiting. They hear it proclaimed. And let me tell you, when they hear it proclaimed, they hear it proclaimed by what I believe was a very large processional. Like when you think about the wise men, you and I think about the three wise men, right? And it's always three. And why is it three? Because there's three gifts, right? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And so we're like, oh, duh, three wise men. Three gifts, three wise men. The east presented them one gift. The Bible does not say that. The Bible just says that there were gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. These wise men were like aristocracy. Like they had authority and position in the place they came from. They were wealthy. They likely came with a huge caravan. I want you to think for a second. I know it's Christmas, but I want you to think Aladdin, okay? Just without the rug and the monkey, although the monkey would be a great part of the story. I mean, I'd be great if the monkey was in the story, but like, I want you to think Aladdin when he's sort of coming in, and it's been many years, but I remember like, he makes up this big deal to pretend that like he's the prince, right? And there's this huge processional. I think I remember an elephant or something, like all this kind of stuff, right, coming in, and it's just, this is what it was more likely like. These were wealthy, powerful, educated people. They didn't make a 900-mile journey with three dudes in a treasure chest. It would have left them over 900 miles. This was a journey. They had soldiers. They had escorts. This was a massive crowd, and they are proclaiming, where is he? Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? And there's this huge processional coming into Jerusalem. Everyone heard it. Some of your skeptical friends say, well, it was kind of done in secret. This was not done in secret. This did not happen in secret. Everyone knew what was going on. The religious leaders would have been the first to hear about it because they were important. They too were the aristocracy. They too were the powerful ones. And they would have been greeting this processional. And all of a sudden, it's not a king with an army and a ton of wealth, ready to crush the Roman Empire. It's just a baby in a manger in a very small city, in an insignificant place with insignificant people. And Jesus was not the one that they were hoping for. And I think a lot of people today have this kind of fear. It's a pessimistic fear. If I follow Jesus, what if he's not actually what I'm looking for? What if he's not actually all he's cracked up to be? What if he's not who they say he is? And I spend my time and my effort and I have my relational capital and I spend it all to get on a journey to follow him, and then it's not actually what it is. I mean, you want to read in verse 7 something like, "Then the wise men left in haste and ran to Bethlehem, to the city they knew the Messiah was born in," you know, holding their robes up when they were running, you know, so they didn't trip because they were running so fast, you know, to get to the place. They knew. Herod called on them. Where is he to be born? They said, in Bethlehem. They knew. And they did nothing. Matter of fact, we know from Jesus' life that they ended up trying to thwart him more than worship him. Question, do you have any pessimistic fear that's keeping you from faith in Jesus or from growing from your faith in him? The wise men are the only ones in the story that don't have any fear. And they had fears. I mean, the fear that they could misread or misinterpret what they had seen, perhaps. They'd read and heard all their effort, all their energy. Maybe fear that Jesus would not be all that they expected. Maybe fear that Herod would want to crush them like he'd want to crush Jesus and just snuff out any proclamation of this happening. Maybe fear that when they came back home, their friends would think they lost their mind. What are you doing? You're doing what? You're following who? You worship who? You went to see who? But they moved past their fears and they moved toward Jesus. And that would be my question for you this morning. Are you willing to move past your fear and move a little bit more toward Jesus? The wise men did, and they had this incredible experience. We see it starting in the second half of verse 9, where it says, "And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to the rest over the place where the child was." This is moving around wherever Jesus, kind of like a drone in New Jersey, you know, just kind of. When they saw this, not really like that, but probably brighter. "When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary's mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. And then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh." And then here this morning with you thing is that our journey to faith culminates in worship of Jesus. This is where this ends. Our journey of faith, it culminates. It ends with worship of Jesus. I just want to say, it doesn't really matter where or when or how you start a journey. It matters how it ends. It doesn't matter where, when, or how you leave from a place. It just matters that you get there. It doesn't matter if it starts and stops or a little curve in the road or a fork in the road or it took a long time or you chose the longest route. It just matters that you end up there. It doesn't really matter where or when or how you started your journey to Jesus or with Jesus. It just matters where it ends. And our journey to Jesus doesn't end by being supportive of other people who are expecting Jesus. This was Herod. Herod was from Idumea. He practiced Judaism outwardly. He didn't really know everything, as we know. He needed someone to tell him where the Messiah was to be born. He knew the Christ was coming, but he didn't know where. He had a sort of external appearance of kind of being a religious kind of guy. But he was supportive of the Jews. He helped them to build the temple. So he's supporting other people that are waiting for Jesus. But that's not where our journey ends. It doesn't end by just being supportive of other friends. Maybe you're here and you're not yet a Christian and you're thinking to yourself, yeah, well, you know, my part in this is just being supportive of my family member or my friend or my coworker because, you know, that's good for them and I want to be supportive. That's not where Jesus wants your journey to end. And our journey doesn't just end by saying that we want Jesus. This is what the masses did. The masses were saying, we want a Messiah. We want the deliverer. We want him to come. We want Jesus to come. And then when he came, they didn't do anything. They were troubled also. It said, and Herod was troubled and all of Jerusalem with him. This was the masses. They just were saying, they were saying that they wanted him, but they didn't do anything when he was actually born. And our journey to Jesus doesn't just end by studying books that are all about Jesus. This was the chief priests and the scribes. They studied the Old Testament. They studied other Old Testament-ish kind of religious literature. They'd been studying and they'd been writing books about the coming of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And they'd studied all the books, but that's where it ended for them. I think about, you know, probably the religion professor at Harvard, you know, knows so much about the New Testament, knows nothing about Jesus, likely, or some Ivy League school, I don't know. This is not where Jesus wants it to end. You know some academic facts about Jesus. He doesn't want it just to end there. Our journey to Jesus can only rightly end in the worship of Jesus. That's where the journey is supposed to end. That's where it's meant to end. That is the destination. And there are a lot of ways that we can worship Jesus, but there are two mentioned in this passage I think are pretty fantastic. The first one is that worship begins by bending our knee to Jesus. Worship begins by bending our knee to Jesus. And going into the house, they saw the child, Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. This word worship means, or literally means, falling down. Falling down on your knees, paying homage. It's just getting on your knees, and, you know, if you do yoga, it's like the child pose. And I was going to do it, but I don't want to blind you with the top of my head. You know, but you go all the way down, right? You put your head on the carpet, and that's what it is. It's literally bowing as low as you can get. It's bending the knee and bowing as low as you could get in reverence, showing your allegiance, showing your dependence, and showing your submission to someone. And this is where it ends. It ends with us bowing before Jesus, bending the knee, which is not easy sometimes at first. We're a little unsure. Do I want to bend the knee to anyone? Please trust me. Jesus is the kind of person you want to bend your knee to. Jesus, let me rephrase that. Jesus is the only kind of person that you want to bend your knee to. You bend your knee to Jesus, and you say, this is my ultimate reverence, ultimate allegiance, ultimate dependence, ultimate submission. I will submit myself to you. I will depend on you. I revere you. I will be loyal to you. Question this morning, where do you need to bend your knee to Jesus? For many of you, you're followers of Jesus, and you know there's an area of your life that you need to get on your knees. You know, you just need to give that over to him as an act of worship to him. And for some of you, you need to get on your knees for the first time and say, like, yeah, I'm here. I'm in a vulnerable, humble position because I can't do this anymore on my own. And here I am, you know. And you've been on a journey to Jesus, and I'm just telling you, it's going to end with you bending your knee to Jesus in worship of Jesus. But worship continues by giving our gifts to Jesus. It says, going in, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. This word for treasures is the place for which good and precious things are collected. Maybe you have a place like that in your house. You got a safe or a gun safe somewhere that's fireproof, and you open it up, and all your precious things are in there. Yes, you store your gold bars that you bought at Costco this Christmas season. And that's where you put it. And that's what they had. Probably not from Costco, but they had gold. And they had frankincense, an ingredient used in perfume for the most holy place in the temple, very expensive. And they had myrrh, an aromatic resin that was used to embalm bodies. And we know that their gifts were very significant gifts. They were worth a lot of money. We know they were also symbolic. They probably had no idea that these gifts pointed to the wealth and royalty of Jesus, the gold. They pointed to the Jesus being the priest of all priests, the temple, and the myrrh, Jesus' burial. They had no idea, likely, but it was a significant gift. And let me just say, they didn't give a small portion of these things to Jesus. You don't give a small gift to a king. And so likely they gave a lot of what they had. They opened their treasuries and they gave Jesus much of what they had. I think the question for us is, what good and precious things of our lives do we need to give to Jesus in an act of worship? See, when you come to Jesus and you worship him, it starts by bending the knee to him, but it continues in offering our gifts to him and saying, I want to give you my money and my possessions. I want it to be used toward the work that you were doing. I want to offer my work to you. I want to do my work for you and unto you so that I can help be part of the things that you are doing. I want to submit this relationship to you. It's the one that you want for me. I want it to continue to move forward. I want to give over my dreams and my hopes and my aspirations because I believe you probably have bigger and better ones for me, and I want to know what they are. And we submit those things, and we offer our gifts to him. This is a picture of what worship looks like, and I got to tell you, this is where the joy is. If you're a follower of Jesus, you know this, right? You know that when you bend the knee to Jesus and you offer him, humbly you offer him everything, and then you open your gifts and all the things that you have and you lay them at his feet, you know that's where the greatest joy is, amen? Come on, Christians. Yeah. Yeah, there's probably some not yet Christians in our mix. We're like, oh, I don't know, you know, it could be kind of good. No, it's like that's where the joy is. We all know that. It says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And I can't say a lot about this now, but there are four joys there. Rejoiced exceedingly great joy. In the language, there are four joys. And the Bible doesn't have highlighter. It doesn't underline things. When it repeats things, it's trying to make a point. Rejoiced exceedingly great joy. Joy, 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 joy. It's saying this is where the joyful life is. When you worship Jesus, you humble yourself before him. You offer who you are to him. And you allow him to do through your life and the things that you have more than you could ever imagine on your own. Lastly this morning, and very quickly, verse 12. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. And the last little thing we learned here this morning is that our journey to faith multiplies by sharing our personal encounter with Jesus. And I just want to say up front for you Bible students, this is more implicit than explicit in the text. But I want to say this. Does this sound like the type of experience the wise men wouldn't want to share with everyone back home? I mean, do you get the picture from reading this? We don't know what happened after this, but do you get a picture from reading this? They're like, yeah, I'm probably not going to say anything to anyone. 900-mile journey, supernatural star. We met a king. Oh, we met the King of Kings, by the way, and God spoke to us in a dream. But, you know, whatever. Probably keep that to myself. And these wise men seem to be the types of people now who wouldn't want to share their experience with Jesus. They've obviously been changed by him. So, Village Church, I just want to ask you, is your experience with Jesus the kind of experience that you'd want to share with people around you? I just want to ask you for a moment to think back on your journey with Jesus, and where it started and where you are today. And can I just humbly ask you, is that something you'd want to tell people about? I think the answer is probably yes. And I know you, and I know you're the kind of people who would want to share your experience with Jesus with everyone you know. Because what you know is that Jesus' life started with his birth, but it didn't end there. You know that Jesus lived a sinless life before God. That's what the Bible says, a life that you and I could never live, a life perfectly sinless before God. And the Bible says he did it on our behalf. And you also know that Jesus went to the cross, that his life started in a wooden manger, but his life ended on a wooden cross. And you know that he died there on the cross and in your place and for your sins. For all the times that you pushed him away, that you didn't overcome the fear, that you disobeyed, disregarded him, that you did your own thing, you built your own kingdom without him, all the sin in your life, it was all put on Jesus on the cross. And you also know that Jesus rose from death 3 days later to prove who he was, that he was the Son of God, our Savior, the Christ, that he defeated death and hell, that he absorbed God's wrath on your behalf on the cross. He rose 3 days later to prove it. And you also know that he said he's coming again. And that Christmas is the first Advent, and we have another Advent that's coming up, that Jesus said he's going to return. And you know the whole story, and this is the good news this morning because of it, that Jesus made his journey all the way to the cross so that we could be forgiven and free to follow him. And I hope that's good news for you this morning. For many of you who know Jesus, I know you know what this means. And for those of you who don't yet know him, we hope that your journey towards Jesus ends in worship of Jesus, ends in faith this Christmas season. Would you pray with me? Jesus, one of the things that I and that we love about you most is that you're not unwilling, you don't ask us to do anything that you're unable or unwilling to do yourself. So Lord, you're asking us to step out in faith and take a journey toward you and with you. But you did that in the beginning. You came from heaven to earth. This is what we're celebrating during Christmas. That you came from heaven to earth. You left the comforts of heaven to come to earth. You lived, you died, you rose, you ascended. And Jesus, we believe you're returning. And so thank you for making your way to us. Thank you that Christianity is the only belief system in the world where God makes his way to us. We're not trying to earn our way to him. Jesus, we thank you for making the journey to us. We thank you for inviting us along to you and to a journey with you. We love you. We celebrate you this Christmas season. Amen. Mm-hmm.